we've lost the ability to distinguish between democracy and capitalism. And the very fact that we have more people in prison than in any other country in the world is an indication that there's something terribly wrong.
One of the first things I saw covering the pandemic was the call to social distance, a call to stay at home. But yet, just a few miles from here, the workers still building the wall.
This country was built on the backs of black people across this country. And if we don't have it, you ain't gonna have it either, because we gonna tear it up. And people ought to understand.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates, focused on COVID-19 and the many ways in which this pandemic touches people's lives. I'm your host and producer, Akua Holt. In today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy, we hear from Dr. Joy DeGruy, author of Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, and from the Pacifica Archives, a historic clip of civil rights icon Fannie Lou Hamer, writer and activist Tony Diaz, and Patricia Jones, a certified nurse midwife, reporting on the challenges of pregnant women during this COVID pandemic, and much, much more. But first, the news with Lisa Loving from our affiliate station KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
These are the headlines for Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Lisa Loving for KBOO Community Radio. The state of Texas officially paused its reopening Thursday morning as a major surge of new infections swamped hospitals and Governor Greg Abbott faced calls to resign. Abbott made the move right after issuing an executive order limiting non-essential medical procedures in the state's four biggest counties to make more hospital beds available for COVID patients. Medical experts say the spike in infections followed an aggressive reopening on Memorial Day weekend in late May. This week, the hashtags Abbott Resign and Abbott Betrayed Texas trended nationally on Twitter, with tens of thousands of tweets criticizing the governor for reopening the state too early and failing to mandate masks in public. Texas has reported almost 32,000 new cases and 191 deaths over the past week. As of midnight Wednesday, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut are requiring visitors from states with high coronavirus infection rates to quarantine for 2 weeks as a condition of entering. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy, and Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont joined in the travel advisory. The states impacted by the policy right now include Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, Texas, and Utah. In North Carolina, three police officers have been fired after one was recorded in an accidentally activated dash cam video calling for a civil war, quote, to wipe black people off the map. The video came to light after a regular monthly dash cam audit conducted by the Wilmington Police Department, which fired Corporal Jesse Moore and officers Kevin Piner and Brian Gilmore Tuesday after charging them with violating standards of conduct. The video includes racist comments by all three officers. One, Piner, says he's ready for a civil war and is planning to buy a new assault rifle. The Associated Press reports that each of the officers admitted they made the racist comments, but all denied being racist. In related police accountability news, yesterday activist Sean King published Facebook posts indicating current and retired law enforcement officials in California have been planning to assassinate him. In a column published in the Medium this week, King released screenshots showing multiple individuals in a private Facebook group called California Law Enforcement Officers posting with their own names, calling for him to be shot, among other things. King said, quote, I feel the burden to release this publicly for my own safety and for the safety of my family. And finally, Tina Knowles Lawson has written a letter to Congress calling for COVID relief legislation that sets aside money for creating better ballot access for voters during the November elections. Known by most people as Beyoncé's mother, Knowles Lawson is supporting the HEROES Act, which, if passed, would provide $1.6 billion for state administration of elections programs. Working with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, Knowles Lawson cited elections in Kentucky this week in which only one polling place opened to serve 600,000 voters, describing the current system as modern-day voter suppression, plain and simple. And those are the headlines in today's news. I'm Lisa Loving from KBOO Community Radio.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
You're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Dr. Joy DeGruy examines how long enduring trauma, that's post-traumatic slave syndrome, in the African-American community is passed down from generation to generation. Dr. DeGruy says people who continue to be oppressed experience trauma each time they're exposed to violent acts. Here, she breaks down the language and behavior of a person experiencing trauma.
Post-traumatic slave syndrome is an explanatory theory that really looks at multi-generational trauma. One of the things that's difficult for people is their first response is, oh my God, that happened so long ago. We're talking about people being captured, shipped, sold, beaten, raped, experimented on. And then you have to ask the question, did the trauma continue? Yes, so 300 years of trauma, no help, freed. No help, more trauma. If it's a sustained trauma, then the impact of that is also sustained. When we look at multi-generational trauma, we're looking at people who are maybe victims of natural disasters and their families and their children and generations of folks who have experienced war. And we know that there are residual mental, emotional, traumatic impact. And what I did was I started to look at the African-American experience, starting with slavery, as a real clear, long-enduring trauma. So I started to see that there were clear connections between that survival behavior and contemporary living in African-American experience. I started to see common behaviors that I took for granted as, well, cultural. There's adaptive behaviors, survival behaviors. Well, what are they? Let's just say 2019, you have a black mother and a white mother. The sons go to school together. They find themselves at a meeting. The black mother leans over to the white mother and says, I just wanted to mention to you that I noticed that your son is really doing quite well. And the white mother's response is, oh, thank you. She begins to go on and on about he won the science fair, his uncle's an astronaut. She's just oozing. She realizes the black mother's son is actually excelling her son. And she says, well, wait a minute. Your son's the one that's really coming along. And the black mother responds, oh my God, he's a handful, but oh, he just works my nerves. Now, when I'm working with African-American people, it doesn't matter what the audience is. It doesn't matter what class. If I were to ask, is she very proud while she's saying those denigrating things? And everybody laughs and goes, of course, there's a secret. Because everybody black knows that even though the black mother is going, oh my God, she's really proud. So now let's roll that scene back 300 years. And let's say this black mother is working in the fields and a white slave owner comes through and says, wow, that boy is really coming along. What is she gonna say? No, he's not. He's stupid. He's shiftless. He can't work because I don't want you to sell him. So I denigrate them to protect them. That is called appropriate adaptation when living in a hostile environment. The little white boy, say Timmy, you know, he feels really comfortable and happy about what his mom just said about him. And Trey looks at his mom and wonders, why can't you be proud of me? Because he doesn't understand the secret yet. And by the time he learns the secret, he will have already been injured by it. Post-traumatic slave syndrome. PTSD is a disorder that occurs as a result of a single trauma. You don't even have to be there to actually get a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. You could just hear about something horrific happening to someone you love. So you have people who have experienced it firsthand, people who have witnessed it in their environment, right? People who are continuing to be oppressed. That exacerbates any possibility of healing. So it's not post-traumatic stress disorder, because then it becomes part of what we call your socialization process. So you begin to normalize a way of living and being, everything from what we eat to what we believe it means to be a friend. You know, all of these things are colored by history. And if you don't understand it, you're going to fold in things that you've just assumed are normal. But post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, exaggerated startle response, outbursts of anger, feeling of foreshortened future. There was a point where there were, you know, African-American children in different urban settings that didn't expect to live to be adults because they saw so much death, that they started planning their funerals like at 13, 12, as young as 10. When you start looking at the simple biology, you start looking at the impact of stress on health. And while we look at general stress, you know, we know finances, you have illnesses, all these different things. How about being Black? How does factoring in being Black in America impact your stress level and therefore your body's ability to operate its own immune system? Because we know it compromises the immune system. Once you understand it, then you can deal with it. Because you see, it's habitual. You socialize. It becomes part of your being. So one of the ways you begin to address that multi-generational trauma is to work with the people it directly impacts, to hear from them. And when you give the people the information, they can use it. I think the first order of business is beginning to have a conversation. And the other is to educate the larger society. You have to stop the assault. So this is not purely a clinical thing. This requires social justice and change. That's where part of the healing is. It's not in a clinical setting or in a pill. It's in fairness and justice and safety and equity. We got to work with some of those clinical things, some of those issues of panic and anxiety. And we also have to deal with the fact that you have a system that is set up to oppress you and to continue to injure you. Both those things have to be dealt with. And they cannot singularly by themselves affect a change. They have to be done collectively.
Next on COVID, Race, and Democracy, a clip from the Pacifica Archives, civil rights icon Fannie Lou Hamer, one of the most influential and powerful voices from the Mississippi Delta to become a leader in the civil rights movement and a champion for Black voting rights in the South. In 1964, Hamer gained national attention as co-founder of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which challenged the local Democratic Party's efforts to block African American voter participation. And again, this was 1964. Fannie Lou Hamer.
Mississippi is still a very rough place. You know, people is not just walking up like they used to do in the past, walking out, you know, shooting a man down or getting maybe 200 or 300 people carrying you out and lynching you, but it's in a more subtle way, you know, they can let you starve to death, not give you jobs. These are some of the things that's happening right now in Mississippi. See, Mississippi is not actually Mississippi's problem. Mississippi is America's problem. Because if America wanted to do something about what has been going on Mississippi, it could have stopped by now. It wouldn't have been in the past few years, between 40 and 50 churches bombed and burned. You see, and this, you know, this lead me to say, you know, all of the burning and bombing that was done to us and the houses, nobody never said too much about that, and nothing was done. But let something be burned, you know, by a Black man, and then, my God, you know, you see, the flag is drenched with our blood. Because you see, so many of our ancestors was killed because we have never accepted slavery. We had to live on it, but we've never wanted it. So we know that this flag is drenched with our blood. So what the young people are saying now, give us a chance to be young men respected as a man. As we know, this country was built on the black backs of black people across this country. And if we don't have it, you ain't gonna have it either, because we gonna tear it up. That's what they saying. And people ought to understand. I don't see why they don't understand it. They know what they've done to us. All across this country, they know what they've done to us. This country is desperately sick. And man is on the critical list. I really don't know where we go from here.
A clip from the Pacifica Archives. Hamer was one of the most influential and powerful voices from the Mississippi Delta to become a leader in the civil rights movement and a champion for black voting rights in the South. In 1964, Hamer gained national attention as co-founder of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which challenged local Democratic Party's efforts to block African American voter participation. And again, this was 1964.
What we want. We want to love ourselves freely. Unfettered images of our grandmothers and our dreams. We want to praise our own God. And we want to see his reflection in our children's eyes. We want to draw in blue like jazz with long dreads and thick lips. We want music every day and especially on Sunday. We want dancing to be a prerequisite for success. We want the blues and jazz and funk, rock, soul, hip hop and R&B and the wealth created from it to be our baby's inheritance. And we want it taught in all elementary schools all over the world. We want to speak for ourselves, we want to represent ourselves, and we don't want no handouts. Yeah, we don't want handouts. We just want everything we created and everything that was created as a result of what we created, and we want it with interest. We need a guaranteed income for all, education like fresh air and food and water and shelter, and be free from sickness and dis-ease. We need long life to collectively oppose death and stagnation. We need ideas and imagination. We should be against hoods like sheeted white ones, the ones that take and keep taking from the meek and often defenseless, even the glorified trap. Yeah, we against the trap too. We need our skies to be free from poison, to be able to breathe in sunshine and feel the wind on our faces. We need to end the war and oppression. We need the people to own their own labor. We need every corner of every country developed and every community empowered. We need it all turned right side up. We need the raw materials from the earth used in poverty anywhere exists. We need the calluses on our hands and the pains in our lower back to be added to our savings. Yeah. We need healthcare to be free, and information to be free, and ideas to be free, and the news to be free, and learning to be free, and the people to be free. Yeah, the people, they gotta be free too. We need inner slavery in all forms and inner exploitation, and we need all the money and all the banks in every part of the world to be used for our collective benefit. Yeah, we need all the money and all the banks in every part of the world to be used for our collective benefit. We need to outlaw lies and teach people's history in all languages from the viewpoint of all of us, not just a few of us. We need to outlaw everyone. We need to outlaw everyone. We need to outlaw everyone who opposes the right for all of us to vote, to be represented, no matter where we are, no matter what language we speak, no matter what God we pray to dismantle the Electoral College. Yeah, we need to dismantle the Electoral College and make racism and white supremacy illegal. We need to ban the Confederate flag and label every monument to genocide with a red letter like that book, or just plain tear them down. And replace them with statues of black and brown women that carried us through the darkest moments of history. We need to destroy all nuclear weapons, but first start with automatic rifles. We need to replace the war on drugs with a war on ignorance. We need to destroy the pipeline of cages and use the savings to develop the human spirit to treat illness, social, mental, and physical. We need freedom. Not just the Bill of Rights, but rights to build our own lives, to be free from destituteness and hatred and hungry children, free from sickness with cures, underdevelopment and cold winter nights with no heat, free from losing our land, our block, our community, our homes, our family, free from choking to death in our own backyard. And schools that undermine our self-esteem, we need to be free from praising those that lynched us. We need to be free from praising those that lynched us, and free to pray in any language and to anyone we choose. Free to be free how we define it. We need to be free how we define it, and free enough to know that the world is made up of all of us, not just some of us, and that only when all of us are free, none of us will be. and that our collective existence is tied directly to our individual existence, a coexistence with ourselves. Yeah, one big we, one big we, one big giant outrageous we. This is what we want and what we need. This is what we want and what we need, what we want and what we need, and we want it now. We want it now at this very moment, this second. This is what we want and what we need, the now, and the forever and the now and the forever and the forever now. We want it, we want it, we want it, what we want and what we need, what we want and what we need and want and need and want and need like a shower all over our body, like a shower all over our body. We want it. Like the sunshine kissing our faces. Yeah, like the sunshine kissing our faces.
That was Roz Baraka, poet and mayor of Newark, New Jersey. What we want.
I wear garments touched by hands from all over the world. 35% cotton, 65% polyester. The journey begins in Central America in the cotton fields of El Salvador. In a province soaked in blood, pesticide sprayed workers toil in a broiling sun, pulling cotton for $2 a day. Then we move on up to another rung, Cargill. A top 40 trading conglomerate takes the cotton through the Panama Canal. Up the eastern seaboard, coming to the U.S. of A. for the first time. In South Carolina, at the Burlington Mills, joins a shipment of polyester filament courtesy of the New Jersey Petrochemical Mills of DuPont. DuPont strands of filament begins in the South American country of Venezuela, where oil riggers bring up oil from the earth for $6 a day. Then Exxon, largest oil company in the world, upgrades the product in the country of Trinidad and Tobago, then back into the Caribbean and Atlantic seas to the factories of DuPont. On the way to the Burlington Mills in South Carolina to meet the cotton from the blood-soaked fields of El Salvador. In South Carolina, Burlington factories hum with the business of weaving oil and cotton into miles of fabric for Sears, who takes his bounty back into the Caribbean Sea, headed for Haiti this time. May she be one day soon free. Far from the Port-au-Prince Palace, third world women toil doing piece work to see a specification for $3 a day. My sisters make my blouse. It leaves the third world for the last time, coming back into the sea to be sealed in plastic for me, this third world sister. And I go to the Sears department store where I buy my blouse on sale for 20% discount. On my hands
clean. You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Thanks for listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. We now go to Dr. Bernice King, youngest daughter of Coretta Scott King and Dr. Martin Luther King. Mourners attended Rashad Brooks' private service in Atlanta, Georgia, at the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once served as co-pastor. A public viewing for Brooks was held on Monday. Garrett Roth, the officer who reportedly fatally shot Rashad Brooks, was terminated from the Atlanta Police Department. He is now facing 11 charges, including felony murder. Dr. Bernice King spoke at the funeral of Rashad Brooks. King said, quote, "Her heart deeply grieves, and that she knew the pain of growing up without a father and the ongoing attention around his tragic loss," unquote. She also recalled historic events that occurred on June 12th. In 1963, on June 12th, civil rights leader Medgar Evers was shot and killed in front of his home. And on June 12, 1964, Nelson Mandela, lawyer and anti-apartheid activist, was sentenced to life in prison in South Africa. Mandela spent 27 years behind bars before he was eventually released and went on to become South Africa's first black president. King said the date, June 12, will now be a constant reminder of the struggle for justice. She said, quote, "Atlanta is being called to task now, and the answer is not more diversity and inclusion." King said, "It's now time for Black Lives Matter."
If we miss this moment, we will find ourselves returning again and again to a pathway of chaos and self-destruction. So to all of my activists, to all of my organizers and people of goodwill, we cannot stop our cry for justice and our fight for freedom. We cannot stop our demonstrations until our voices are heard and our demands for police reform are met. We must not stop until white supremacist policies and practices are no longer the order of today. We will not stop until voter suppression is a thing of the past. We will not stop until reparations sets us on a path to be free at last. We will not stop until our leaders are no longer polarized between Democrat and Republican, but are united in a clarion call for healing and just and equitable policies that overcome the racial disparities. Don't you stop until Black Lives Matter in every state, in every city, in every hamlet, in every village, in every sector of American society, and ultimately the world. And I close that in honor of Ahmaud Arbery, in honor of Breonna Taylor, in honor of George Floyd, in honor of Rashad Brooks and countless others, don't stop until it matters that dignity, justice, and equity are a reality for all black lives. Rashad Brooks' death will not be in vain, because justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
Legendary scholar and activist Angela Davis.
I followed you when you were at UCSD and the turmoil that you encountered trying to get to UCLA. And to see you rise and still stand, it's truly amazing. And it's truly someone is looking out for you. My question to you is that many black people have a different opinion about American democracy. And my question to you, what's your view regarding selling democracy to the Middle East?
Well, it seems to me that we've lost the ability to distinguish between democracy and capitalism. It is, I think, an effort to sell capitalism to the Middle East that's going on. Our president rarely makes the distinction. And I think that it is up to other voices
to begin a conversation about a democracy that will raise all of the issues that are silenced in during this period. This is what I would say. I could refer to some of those issues. I could talk about economic democracy. I could talk about educational democracy. I could talk about democracy in relation to the horrendous situation we encounter in our prison system, and the very fact that we have more people in prison than in any other country in the world is an indication that there's something terribly wrong with the particular kind of democracy that exists in this country.
You just heard from legendary scholar and activist Angela Davis.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thank you.
child. Everybody seems to think we're wrong, but who are they to judge us? Simply because our hair is long. Don't you know we gotta find a way to bring some understanding here today? Oh, picket lines, picket signs, don't punish me.
This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Our featured story today is Tony Diaz. Tony and his team produced two radio shows on KPFT, Latino Politics and News and Nuestra Palabra, Latino Writers Having Their Say. Award-winning journalist Alfredo Cachara speaks to Latino Politics and News about a New York Times op-ed he wrote, quote, "A farm worker on American hypocrisy," unquote. The article breaks down how undocumented workers are labeled essential workers as they pick crops to supply America's vulnerable food chain during the COVID-19 pandemic, but are vilified by the Trump administration the rest of the time.
Tell us about the evolution of this piece. How long were you thinking about it, and at what point did the first lines sink into your imagination?
I've been thinking about it for a while. First of all, the essay was inspired by my second book, Homelands. And there's a passage in chapter 7, it's called Fickle America. And it looks at the United States and how they want it both ways. One day they love you. I always remember my father telling me the story about when he first arrived at Sabrosero in the 1950s in California, and there was this sort of a festive atmosphere. You know, you're here, let's do a carne asada. He talked about going to a movie theater in Fresno, and there were signs, "Bienvenidos los braceros." And you compare that to today, living on the border. One of the first things I saw covering the pandemic was the call to social distance, a call to stay at home, sort of hunker down and not be around people, wear a face mask. But yet, just a few miles from here, there were workers still building the wall, the president's wall, the big, bold, beautiful wall that he's called for. And in reporting that, you kind of question this country and you question the hypocrisy. And you go back to your days as a field worker, as a farm worker in California, when the migra vans would show up. And it was usually during the latter part of the season, in August, right before when school started again. And that was always a sign that the season was coming to an end and that it was time to haul them away, taken back to Mexico. So I think that has always kind of stayed with me, you know. As we say in Mexico, la doble moral del país, the dual morality of a country. That has always bothered me. It's always made me question the anti-immigrant rhetoric. I guess it's been festering during the pandemic. You know, you go to a grocery store and you see these, whether it's the melons or the vegetables. And I always wonder, because I was like, I mean, I once did that for a living, helped my parents, you know, I would help in the summers and the springs to try to make enough money to buy the school supplies, to buy new clothing for the school year. But my mind always kind of wonders when I see these vegetables, and it makes me think, who's picking them today? These people are so essential. I mean, these workers are so essential. Some of them still my relatives, and yet they call them illegal.
That's really a powerful context. And I think it also speaks to the fact that we as Latinos, Mexican-Americans, Chicanos, Latinx, we've always got to perform at a higher level than everyone else. I'm going to ask you two questions. The second one is going to dive into the aesthetic work that you did in this piece, which is profound. But I want to start by saying how straightforward the piece is too. You also link it to some of the policies that have been played with right under our noses. A lot of them run into this anti-immigrant scapegoating that turns into policy that's changed and comes back again, that has real life-changing impacts for our community. How do you contain it? You did a really wonderful thing of linking it to your life experience, but by the same token, you have to cut a lot out. Like you mentioned, you've written entire books on this subject. You live it. How do you walk that tension between letting it become a novel length work and then here being so concise in a column length?
I think it's part of it is a training as a journalist. I often tell people, when sources know my history, they know my background, the first question they ask is, are you really objective? Can you really tell the story? And so I've always felt a need to fight back by trying harder to listen to their story, to make sure that the stories I write have two sides, that they're balanced. And sometimes it's more than two sides. You know, they could be multiple sides. But you have to balance that. You have to try to get their voices in. You have to try to be fair as heck, because you are a journalist, and I love and really respect my profession. At the same time, it's a family history. It's what I've seen. It's what I've witnessed. Yes, you can write a book and you can pour it in the book. But I think in moments like this, you also have to draw on your own experience to try to get across to your fellow citizen, your fellow American, and say, look, what we're doing, you may not want undocumented workers, but at least understand the context, understand that perspective, understand where they fit in today's society. You know, you can't just say, these people are critical to the infrastructure of the country, of the food supply. You can't just call them essential without realizing that you've also made them illegal. You've also made them part of this shadowy existence. In moments like that, I know you got to kind of get off the sidelines and really listen to yourself and go back to what you lived through and put that on paper.
That was Tony Diaz and Alfredo Cachada, author of Homelands and Midnight in Mexico. Cachada is also the Mexico border correspondent of the Dallas Morning News.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
We now go to news from Colombia. on May 19th in Cacao, an area located in the southwestern part of Colombia, Dani San Juan reported that 24-year-old Anderson Arboleda died from injuries caused by police officers. Arboleda was attacked while he was unarmed and accused of breaking the quarantine curfew. 6 days later in the United States, Officer Chauvin killed George Floyd without regard for his humanity. As the United States and the rest of the world turned their attention to Black Lives Matter, Colombian artists and activists have raised their voices regarding the case of Arboleda, a young Black Afro-Cuban. A major protest was held in front of the U.S. Embassy in Colombia to protest police brutality and the deaths of Black people transnationally. Black Lives Matter Colombia posted this message online after the incident.
¿Hay racismo en Colombia?
Sí, hay.
Soy igual a ti.
Hago parte de tu ADN como nación.
En esta sociedad no somos tratados como iguales.
Aunque somos humanos.
El racismo es una de las pandemias más viejas y destructivas.
La vida de las personas negras importa.
Las vidas negras importan.
Tu vida importa.
La de nuestra ancestra.
La de mi madre.
La de tu madre.
La de mi hermana.
La de mi hija.
La vida de nuestros ancestros.
Las de nuestros padres.
La de tu hijo.
Sabremos que las vidas negras importan cuando podamos vivir en una sociedad equitativa.
Cuando se valore el poder de lo invisible.
Cuando se haga justicia por Anderson Arboleda.
Hasta que no dejen de aterrorizar a la gente negra.
Queremos vivir en un mundo libre de violencias. Justicia para Anderson Arboleda.
Justicia por Anderson Arboleda.
Justicia por Anderson Arboleda.
Justicia para Anderson Arboleda.
Justicia para Anderson Arboleda.
Justicia por Anderson Arboleda.
Por Anderson Arboleda.
That was Black Lives Matter Colombia, raising awareness about the death of 24-year-old Anderson Arboleda, who died at the hands of officers in Colombia.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
In this final segment of COVID, Race, and Democracy, Patricia Jones, who's a registered nurse, a certified nurse midwife, and host of KPFT's Whole Mother program, gives an update on the latest COVID-19 guidelines for pregnant women. Here's Pat Jones.
I am Patricia Jones, registered nurse and a certified nurse midwife, and I'm going to tell you about COVID-19 and pregnancy and birth. Current reports show that pregnant women do not have more severe symptoms of COVID-19 than the general public, but researchers are still learning how the illness affects pregnant women. Doctors urge pregnant women to take the same steps as the general public to avoid coronavirus infection. U.S. Centers for Disease Control and American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists released guidelines stating that healthcare facilities may consider separating women with suspected or confirmed COVID-19 from their newborns on a case-by-case basis until there is no longer a concern for transmission. These recommendations are far more cautious than what the World Health Organization recommends, who specifically says not to separate mother and baby when a mother is well enough to breastfeed, even in cases of confirmed or suspected COVID-19. There are several problems with the current advice on birthing during the pandemic. The potential benefit of separating infants is that it may reduce the risk of COVID-19. But the risks and the impacts of COVID-19 for all infants, including those without pre-existing medical conditions, remain unclear. The problems associated with maternal newborn separation, however, are potentially life-changing. Experts consider immediate skin-to-skin contact essential for helping newborns regulate their body temperature after birth, and it's associated with lower mortality. Mothers who are able to immediately practice skin-to-skin contact breastfeed their infants longer, which is important since breast milk is known to be good for an infant's immune system. So breastfeeding could be helpful for newborns who might be exposed to infection. Mother and newborn separation can also hurt maternal emotional well-being, contributing to postpartum depression and even post-traumatic stress disorder. The CDC has also recommended that healthcare facilities consider limiting to one the number of support persons available to women in labor, forcing her to choose between a partner, parent, sibling, friend, or doula. At the height of the pandemic along the East Coast, some hospitals forced women to labor alone. Eliminating support teams comes with costs. Evidence shows that having continuous support throughout labor improves both maternal and newborn outcomes, including a better chance of women having a vaginal delivery as opposed to cesarean section, fewer interventions with instruments like a vacuum and forceps, and better newborn health. Media stories have reported that fears surrounding COVID-19 have led to an increased interest in alternatives to hospital birth, from home birth to birthing centers, often with the attendance of a midwife. Trained support people such as doulas are particularly helpful because they serve as both emotional support and advocates for women during delivery. Unfortunately, structural factors have long prohibited access to non-hospital care for many U.S. women. Private insurance companies often do not reimburse for home births, and Medicaid, which pays for just under half of all births, only covers home birth in approximately half of the states. There are some immediate and practical steps that should be taken to improve things during the pandemic. For example, getting pregnant women out of hospitals and into dedicated birth centers, enacting policy changes to ensure that insurance covers home births and birthing centers, and allowing all qualified midwives to act as independent practitioners in every state. In addition, doulas without symptoms or those who test negative for COVID-19 should also be considered as part of a pregnant woman's care team, not counting as the one allowable companion for a laboring mother. Those kinds of births aren't common in the United States. Only 10% of births are attended by midwives, with 1.6% of women giving birth at home. The governor of New York launched a state task force to determine how to authorize additional birthing centers that women could go to instead of hospitals. In the longer term, increasing and standardizing Medicaid and private insurance reimbursement rates for midwife-attended births would help boost access to out-of-hospital birthing spaces. For many women, hospitals will remain their choice of place for birth, and that's fine. But it's important for U.S. women to be aware of the potential benefits of alternatives and to have access to those alternatives if they choose them. On the other side of the COVID-19 crisis, some of the pressure on the U.S. medical system will be relieved.
This concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates that have contributed to the production of this show. Special thanks to Leanna Lopez and the COVID Task Force. I am Akua Holt, producer and host.
This has been COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily broadcast by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates, produced by a group of committed men and women volunteers willing to make a difference. If you tuned in late, you can listen and download the show from our YouTube channel, Pacifica Foundation TV, or from the website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Tell a friend about it. It will be worth it.